All right, folks, it's 11:20. And we're going to switch a little bit the agenda items in order to streamline a little bit better the rest of the day, some preparatory adjustment. We had item 21, which was going to be last, but based on the amount of time that I see available right now, we will cover item 21 at this time.
Can we do a round for public comments if you can?
Pardon me?
Just ask people if they want a public comment on 21.
On 21, yeah, because I do have several item 21. Let's see. I have one item 21 speaker card from Mr. Schimmick, who is downstairs. Do I see his name on other items? So I have just one. So we are not going to. Yes, sir.
We have the opportunity to put in a speaking card if you're going to be jumping like that, correct?
Which item?
21.
Right now, that's what we're soliciting.
If you want to see item 21, you fill out a card now and we'll take it. So, meantime, please, Ms. McCann, if you can introduce the item.
Okay, yes, this item. This item is item 21. Overview of nitrate treatment technologies for drinking water. It's an informational item to provide the board information on nitrate treatment technologies. Eugene Lund is here today from the Division of Drinking Water to present the item, and we definitely appreciate the time that Mr. Lund is taking to be here today, and also for the continuing good coordination that we have with your staff.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and thank you so much for switching the agenda items. And I think it will really help bring some clarity, actually, to some of the questions you guys had on the earlier topic. So before I jump into the presentation, to answer board members Young's question regarding nitrate data, I just want to let you know that from the Division of Drinking Water, we regulate public water systems. So that's where our program comes in. So it's for water system that serves more than 25 people over 60 days a year, or a system with more than 50 service connections. Both of those are the definition of a public water system. So we have really good clarity for data for those nitrate. In particular, so the water systems in Maury County, for example, it's a cooperative program. The county health department regulates the small water systems, less than 200 service connections to the bottom of the definition. And then the Division of Drinking Water Office out of Monterey regulates the system from 200 service connections and up, so that we share the responsibility and we regulate the same rules. Then when you have the system there, state small water system, so that's below 14 service connection or serve less than 25 people, that becomes a county health regulation. And each county administers that program differently. A lot of them may not require a water system to comply with the nitrate standard. So there's, and then all of that goes down into individual homes, maybe even just 2 to 4 connections. So there's a lot of uncertainty, the fogginess, the pixelation that John talked about. That's where we don't really have the clarity. But for systems that public water system, we actually have a good data set.
And thank you for that clarification. I'm aware of those tiers. And our board has made attempts with some of our counties to get them to require some kind of a testing of their water wells, the small individual wells, and we have met resistance to that. So I'd like to kind of brainstorm over how we might be able to penetrate through that some way.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. So I just wanted to make that clarification in case there were concerns that the public water system, at least we don't know what's going on, but we actually do. And proper notifications being provided if there's any water quality issues. So with that, I'm going to jump into my presentation. Thank you for having me. I'm from the Division of Drinking Water. I work in the Richmond office. I'm the Drinking Water treatment technology unit. So we support our field offices up and down the states for treatment technologies, especially new and emerging technologies. So my presentation today is to give you an overview of the available options for nitrate treatment technologies. So the goal of the presentation is to give you the latest treatment options for nitrate, and especially there are some new technologies being tested out around the states, and kind of bring you the awareness of the key issues that must be addressed to implement these technologies. Some of them are really brand new. We have some of them just in the very starting phase. Some of them is actually optimizing and improving existing technologies, so we'll talk about that. And then since there's a lot of focus on individual private homes or really small homes, may not be belong to a public water system, we have some of that information for you as well. So there was a handout that you should have. If you have two pages, the first page is a flowchart. It kind of like give you like different nitrate treatment options. That's kind of like help you frame what are the treatment options available for public water system. And then on the second page, there is a summary that kind of like highlights the pros and cons of the different treatment technology. So you can have that available to help guide you through the presentation. So on the technologies. So the presentation outline. First, I'm going to touch on. Probably you guys are very aware of this. Just want to make sure everybody's on the same page. Is I'll be touching on the nitrate MCL. We've changed the reporting units in California actually. So sometimes it was 45 and it's now 10. So I'm going to touch on that. Touch on the associated health risk that we talked about it on the early presentation already. How is compliance determined for public water systems? How we look at it, because that really plays into the role how we require treatment. What are the options available? And then also going to touch on the optimized ion exchange, the three technologies that I'm going to touch on today. Optimized ion exchange for the biological treatment, I'm going to touch on the different reactor designs and all of them, what are the variations of it. It's just kind of it's the same concept. It's really much taking a wastewater treatment process into the drinking water well, which is used to have a kind of firewall by actually taking technology from one side to the other, and we're working on that right now. And last but not least, to talk about point of use as an interim solution, because this is a huge problem for systems for private homes where they have high nitrate, and what are their options other than drilling a new well, and it still may not solve the problem. So first, we're going to touch on the nitrate MCL. As I've mentioned, as of July of last year, July 2015, statewide now we report nitrate as nitrogen. So the new MCL now is 10 milligrams per liter, which is about the same as 45 milligrams per liter. If you're really exact, it's like 44.7. But for all grand scheme of things, the standard remains the same. So when the system had a nitrate problem before, they still have a problem now. It didn't go away or exacerbate the problem. And there's also a nitrite MCL that we have to worry about, is 1 milligrams per liter. And I'm bringing up nitrite because whenever you treat nitrate, if you use especially a biological process, you reduce nitrate to nitrite. If you go through an incomplete conversion and it didn't go all the way through to nitrogen gas, you have a problem. So nitrite is 1/10 of nitrate MCL, it's at 1 milligram per liter. So the change in the reporting unit does not affect the MCL, as I mentioned, and now we're consistent to the rest of the country. So when looking at nitrate data, especially in the federal database, we have a very apples to apples comparison, because in the past, always the 45 trip people up, and there's flags all over the place that we're having a problem. So the nitrate MCL, it is an acute health risk. It is what we consider as an acute health risk in the drinking water standard. So we only have really three contaminants that we consider as acute health risk. We have nitrate, we have perchlorate, and then we have E. coli. Those three are things that you can drink a very small volume of water and you can get sick very quickly. So nitrate is one of them, and we consider those tier one violations. So this is something that you can drink a small volume and get sick. So these are the ones that you hear on the evening news. We have a boil water order. But for nitrate, boiling does not work. Boiling will concentrate the nitrate. So it's critical that when you have nitrate problem, you need to seek an alternate source of water, like using bottled water. So the vulnerable populations for nitrate are the infants, that's below the age of 6 months, and also for pregnant women. Those are the two most vulnerable population. And that's how the MCL is set, is for those populations. So the Division of Drinking Water requires systems that provide treatment for nitrate, that provide treated water that meets the drinking water standard at all times. So it's not based on an average, So for all of this, we actually require them to put in an online analyzer that looks at the treated water nitrate all the time and make sure it meets all the standards. And if the treatment starts to go wrong and you're approaching 10, it's actually going to trip the treatment system to turn off. Or it will sound the alarm bell if they only have one well and they have to keep the well running. The system needs to go out and do notification right away that our treatment has failed. Do not drink the water, especially if you're for making baby formulas or if you're pregnant women. So we require immediate notification when a system does fail. So typical treatment target, for all that reason, we usually, the water system, because of the high treatment cost for nitrate, they treat around 80% of the MCL. They don't treat it to as low as possible, like down to 0 mg/L, because it becomes extremely cost prohibitive for all the different technology, from the volume of waste you need to dispose of. So the typical target is you reduce to around 80% of the drinking water standard for, as the starting point for treatment. So if the treatment is very proven, really reliable, we let them move up slightly, perhaps up to 90%, but all of this is governed by an online analyzer. So the treatment target can be achieved. There are different ways to do it. They can either A, have a treatment system that works exceptionally well, bring nitrate down to 1 mg/L and they blend it around, so there's a blending option. Or the other one, they can operate multiple ion exchange filters in parallel. So some of them is a little bit more exhausted, so they're starting to leak nitrate and you have a fresh column that's newly regenerated and mix it together and reach the 80%. We're not prescriptive on how they do it. We allow water system to do one or the other or a combination of those, but the key thing is they need to stay at the treatment target and not go above. So as I mentioned, the analyzer is really helpful. It makes water system provide water that we can be sure the water is safe all the time. But it's a very expensive piece of equipment. It's around $16,000 a piece for the online analyzer. So the general background, so I'm going to switch gears now to the three technologies. And before I go here, actually, if you can please look at the flow chart that I have here. I'm going to jump to this and go back. So the nitrate treatment options, I think it helps with the previous discussion that we had. The non-treatment options is actually what we always advocate for water system, if at all possible. Number one is, it's just kind of like, can they find an alternative source? If we can drill them a new well, and the well meets the drinking water standard, that's the best option. Because they don't have to be burdened with the long-term O&M for operating treatment system. They're just like before, just operating the well. Simple chlorination goes in the system. There's no long-term O&M cost, operation and maintenance cost. The other part is, if we can drill them a new well, we may not have so much capacity, but you have enough of low nitrate water that you can mix the water together to achieve the drinking water standard blending. Those two are the best options for systems at all possible. And the third one is abandon the well completely, and if you can connect to a neighboring water system by consolidating. So they actually get out of the drinking water system business and be able to consolidate. So those are the three things that we actually advocate first before we ever get down to treatment. So under the treatment options, there's kind of two camps, as you can see on this flow chart. On the left side, you have nitrate removal. Whenever you remove nitrate, it actually splits into two streams. You have a clean water stream, and then you have a concentrate stream. You have to do something with the concentrate, so that's the residual side. That's always a challenge. So the treatment option we're going to talk about is ion exchange. That's one of them. And then reverse osmosis. Those are the two technologies. So you've heard UCLA earlier. They are on the reverse osmosis. And I'm going to be telling you about ion exchange a little bit. So those are the two options on that. You do have something concentrated to deal with. Whereas on the right, you have nitrate reduction. So that's actually what I'll be covering as well, is the biological denitrification. So that's a process that we actually have coming online. We have actually the state board has funded and through DWR as well, Department of Water Resources, it's funding a demonstration project in Central Valley. So I'll go into that a little bit. Don't want to give it to all of them. You can see the other two technologies that's mentioned on the flow charts for electrodialysis and chemical denitrification. Although it's listed, it's not technologies that anyone has approached us in California. There was one company that came in hoping to do electrodialysis, but they kind of faded away. And for chemical denitrification, we really haven't had much success to that. Or anyone has have a commercial scale system to come to us. So general background on ion exchange. It's a proven technology. It's very similar to the water softener if you have one at home. It's just using a different type of resin. It's been used very successfully for ion exchange for nitrate, arsenic, and perchlorate. especially if you have a way to get rid of the brine properly. Depending on the resin type, so in, when you use at home for your softener, you're using a cationic resin, so it takes out the cations or positive ions. So your calcium, magnesium, that's what's being removed to give you your soft water. So when you treat it for nitrate, you swap it, you use an anionic resin. So these are the negative resins. So what it does is trading chloride with nitrate. So you add a little bit of chloride, but it takes out the nitrate. So it's a swap. It needs to stay electrically neutral for the resin. So the technical considerations for an exchange, it's whenever you even look at an exchange, it's like you have to compare a new resin versus a regenerated one, whether they're using a nitrate selective resin, which is important for people to use, because if not, you can actually do something worse, that when, as the filter gets exhausted, you can get a big dump of nitrate that's twice as high as what's coming in. So that's a big concern, so picking the right technology. Where they have really optimized the work is regeneration method, which is what I'm going to go into, is how to really minimize the volume of brine that you need to haul away for proper disposal. That's what can reduce the cost of treatment a lot. But no matter what, you have a residual, you have a concentrated nitrate, and then you have some sodium as well. And then your groundwater basin, you guys look at it a lot more than the addition of drinking water, is chloride. Is it a problem for the infinitesimal, very small amount that's being added in? But we need clarity on that so that water system can say, okay, we can do ion exchange and let's put in this treatment and then look at things at different scales. Last but not least is actually everything is always interrelated. There's disinfection byproducts for nitrosamines. This is another potential carcinogen. So when you have the resin, if you somehow feed chlorine ahead of the resin, it destroys the resin, for one thing, but you have very low level to actually create nitrosamines. So it is not so simple. These all need to be properly implemented to really get your desired effect. So ion exchange, as I mentioned, I kind of explained it. So very simple is you have a vessel with a lot of ion exchange resin in it. You have raw water coming in and treated water coming out. Sounds simple enough. That's how you do when it is on the surface cycle. But whenever you regenerate, what you do, you have this ion exchange resin that likes nitrate, so it's grabbed up, it's kind of like a musical chair with resins, so it has completely filled up with nitrate. So the only way for you to kick the nitrate off is you use a really, really strong chloride solution, table salt, NaCl. A really soft solution will displace all of that nitrate and then replace all the spots with chloride. And it's ready to do the exchange again. So that's how it really works. And so, like I said, similar to your softener at home, if you have one, the number one issue, just like softeners, is brine disposal. What do you do with all the spent brine? Now you have nitrate in it. So the key innovation for the company that has worked on it, that we have been working with, is number one, they use an online nitrate analyzer to really drive to efficient operation. They don't regenerate prematurely, they wait till the column is saturated, so they can use the maximum capacity out of it. Next, they have improved the hydraulics, actually. I'm an engineer, so what we want is whenever you have a column, you want the water to move through it efficiently, down the entire column at the same flow rate. So that's the hydraulics that they've worked on. So when you come in, they pretty much have a distributor on the top and bottom. If they can spread out the water evenly, it can regenerate a lot more efficiently. Whereas if you have kind of like a bad sprinkler, you have a lot of water on one side and on the other side, you need to pretty much overwater on one side in order for you to regenerate the whole column. So it's really hydraulic designs has improved a lot. Next is the sulfate return to reduce brine volume. This is kind of the key, actually patented way of doing it. What they have found when you use a nitrate resin, when it's fully loaded with nitrate, when even though it prefers nitrate, it will still take out a lot of sulfate ion into the same ion exchange. And their favorite is chloride, and then nitrate, and then sulfate. So they found that if you just kind of like tease it with a little bit of low concentration chloride, all the sulfate will come up. So they're able to generate a polymer solution with very high sulfate, but not much nitrate. And this sulfate came from the raw water anyway. So they slowly trickle it back into the treated water and get rid of it. So that's one of their big design, is the sulfate return. And then last but not least is for the regenerant, they actually use it twice. So it's a little bit more efficient. They have multiple pots. There's a lot of plumbing that are able to be used to generate more than once to improve efficiency. So this is a picture of these treatment plants. So this particular company, they actually purposely designed things that is containerized.
So since it is in a container, they can build these systems off-site, and when they haul it on, they can put it there, they can lock it, it has better security instead of building a treatment plant. So they have these treatment plants available, and this is a picture of a system, can do 100 to 125 gallons per minute. What you're seeing here on the left is actually, this is a pre-filter. When the water comes in, they have back filters or cartridges to get out of the sand. And it goes through here, you see the three blue columns, those are ion exchange columns. So they operate the principle of three columns at different rates of breakthrough. So the blended solution will be at 80, so at 80% of the MCM, so that's what they do. And down here you see the big black container down here, and this is what they use for hauling away the brine. Concentrated, this is what they need to haul away. So being along the coast is a little bit luckier, so if some of the wastewater treatment plant will be willing to accept the brine, they can actually break down the nitrate as part of the wastewater treatment process, and then have it safely disposed of. For the same systems in Central Valley, they actually need to haul it all the way down to Southern California for disposal, or to the Bay Area to East Bay Mud, or deep injection into the ground. So those are the kind of three options available when you're in the ground. So ion exchange treatment costs. So the key thing for any treatment system is capital cost. So for here, this is to buy the equipment initially, the salt cost, for the brine solution, the brine disposal, where you get rid of the concentrate, and then the routine operations and maintenance. And as you can see from the graph here on the right, is actually the water, the cost goes up linearly. But the higher the nitrate, you can tell from a water that's just over the MCI 11 milligrams per liter, their estimated cost is about $100 per acre foot. But when you go up to 20 milligrams per liter, the treatment cost is as high as $400 per acre feet. And you may say, well, how come you said it's linear and they're not? Because they're operating to 80%. Of the drinking water standard. That's why if you subtract that out, it is linear. Because like it's the increased amount of salt and truckloads that you need to go around. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So treatment performance requirements sorry, I'm duty officer for the division right now, sorry about that. For the treatment performance requirement and other considerations, the nitrate needs to be consistently below the nitrate and nitrite MCL. For the ion exchange resin, especially for a system that sits around, sometimes there is some biological growth inside the resin, so we require continuous disinfection, after which to make sure the water is biologically safe as well. So to ensure treatment reliability, the treated water nitrate must be monitored continuously using the online analyzer. Yeah. And based on the treatment system, there's an operator certification requirement around a T2 facility. So that's a requirement. Ion exchange is, so to kind of in summary, ion exchange is a very mature technology, but also maybe still too difficult for small systems to operate, especially really small systems. A possible solution for small systems is technical consolidation, which is kind of the UCLA project. It's to kind of like build one system that can be remotely operated so that you can have the same type of system and be able to operate it remotely by a treatment operator. There needs to be, like I said, it would be very, very helpful clarity on local regional board's position on ion exchange treatment that would really help with treatment deployment, at least in the public water system, especially in concerns with chloride loading and brine disposal. So now we're going to jump to the other side, the nitrate reduction using biological denitrification process. So the basic for the biological treatment, as I mentioned, is very similar to wastewater treatment. The process from the fundamentals for nitrate and perchlorate is that you have raw water coming in with high nitrate. You actually go through a process, you give it some pretreatment, you put in some nutrients, and you need to you need to encourage the growth so they're breaking down nitrate. So you put in nutrients and also electron donor. The electron donor that's typically used is actually vinegar. And for the nutrient, they use phosphoric acid. Those are the two things that you put in as nutrients. And then you go through a biological reactor. They are very different type of reactor. You just need to think of it as a box. Does the water flow downward or upward? Is the water recirculated a couple times? Do you immerse some membranes in it so that the bugs can grow on the surface of the membrane? So it's just a different type of reactor, but the concept is the same. You have a reactor. And after that, because it's drinking water, we actually need to go through post-treatment, which includes you need to filter out the excess biomass. that may have been growing because of breaking down nitrate. And then probably you definitely need to go through disinfection to kind of like to inactivate the biological process that you've encouraged to grow in the water to break down the nitrate. You need to inactivate, so we need to disinfect it. And after that, the water can't go back into the system safely for drinking, for treated water. So for the breakdown cycle for nitrate, go from nitrate to nitrite to all the way down to nitrogen gas. Yeah, so this is the breakdown sequence, and we need them to take it all the way to completion so they can release it as a harmless nitrogen gas back into the atmosphere. So the key benefit of this is there's no concentrated waste stream. That's a key focus for this technology. But like I've mentioned, like, we really have no experience in drinking water using this technology. Statewide right now, we have biological process. We have three coming on. Two of them is focused on nitrate. One of them is focused on perchlorate that's coming up. So the technology variations, the bioreactor, the different flows I've mentioned already, so I'm not going to repeat that. One really neat one is the biocatalyst. Actually, all the other membrane treatment is pretty much we take what's in the groundwater, encourage the local bacteria to grow, and then so that you're using, so that it will stay consistent, the population. You just need to give it the electron donor and the nutrients, and it will grow. There's one company that's trying a biocatalyst. They actually select strains of bacteria that likes to break down nitrogen and put them inside capsules. So these are little tapioca-sized gel caps that they put them inside, and that's water permeable. So they're trying that right now in Southern California. So one of the big concerns is when you do that process, on the outside of the capsules, the bacteria can take over and kind of like effectively seal off what's inside. So we don't know yet, but this is a commercial concept, so they're going to try it out and see how it works. So the electron donor, here's where it references for acetic acid, nutrients, phosphoric acid. Generally, bioreactors are not pre-seeded and rely on naturally occurring bacteria. So we're not introducing anything. There's nothing seeded into it. It's just what's naturally in the groundwater. We just encourage their growth to break it down. And then the reactor, the key part is it just passed through the reactor once, or this is the recirculator. So the biological sequence, actually, this is kind of important for you to see. This one is courtesy of Enviogen. They have one of the projects going on. So the water actually in this reactor goes from bottom up. Alright, so when the water comes in, the biology of it, it actually first uses up all the oxygen, so it changes oxygen to water. And then the next, after aerobic respiration, when you use up all the oxygen, it becomes an anoxic process. Then it becomes denitrification. After denitrification, it takes out perchlorate. After it uses up all the perchlorate, you use sulfate, and then last, it uses carbon dioxide. So this is the sequence that moves up. So when we are trying to target biological denitrification, we are trying to get to the sweet spot here that is just breaking down nitrate to nitrogen gas, but not so far into sulfate reduction, because you can form hydrogen sulfide, and nobody wants to smell that. So that's the key part. It's like we need to get it at the right part of the biological process. And this works well in a continuous process. So one of the tricky parts, as you know, all the groundwater system is operating intermittently. It has a bladder tank. The water comes up during the morning in the evening rush, and then half the time it sits there a lot. So the big concern is that when the water is sitting there, it will use up all the nitrate. Now it's going to move all the way up to the sulfate reduction. So you have whomever's home first, turn on the tap, you may have a whiff of hydrogen sulfide, and that will... People will lose faith in the drinking water very quickly if it goes down that path. So the key concern for biological treatment is biological treatment is a living treatment process and prefers steady state, a continuous process. During startup and system upset, where can off-spec water be discharged? So even if we put in an online nitrate analyzer, it takes a while for the bacteriological quality to get processed, to get going. It takes around 2 to 3 weeks for the biological process to start up. So what do you do with that huge volume of water? Do you keep serving it? Like, so this is a big issue. The projects that I've mentioned right now all have alternate sources. So this water could be sent to waste. But when dealing with systems that just only have one source, that becomes very tricky when we downsize it. What would be the source of water for customers during the startup and upset? Is there a storage tank? Most systems don't have storage. Most systems for groundwater only have hydropneumatic tanks, little bladder tanks. So if there's a treatment upset, there's no backup water. When the well is out, you have no water. So, and one of the big concerns in system upset, as I mentioned, that being complete reduction may occur and result in excess nitrite, which can do more harm than good. So that's a huge concern for our division. So key concerns for biological treatment is even if you fix it, how quickly can the system recover from a chemical water flow interruption, like if the well broke down for 2 weeks, now that the process has gone dry, how do you keep it, get it back up and running? And so generally speaking, we write site-specific testing is required when someone proposes. They need to do a pilot scale, make sure the biological process works well. They have their control points of how much chemicals to move, to put in, how much electron donor, how much food, everything to get it balanced out. So that we want them to pilot before they scale it up. We don't want them to just put in a big system and hope for the best, because it may not work. So in this picture here, it just shows kind of like a flow diagram. So fluidized bed, all it means is the water is flowing up, so all the media is a little bit expanded, so that's fluidized bed. So this one, the picture here, this is a downflow. So you just can think of like a pool filter, water coming from the top, water flowing out is a downflow process. So compared to fluidized bed, the one I forgot to mention up there, the current technology, when it's upflow, the water is actually get recirculated for it. So if a single pass, it doesn't remove all the nitrate, you actually need a recirculation stream for it to get proper treatment. For the downflow one, the designs we've seen so far is a single pass. So the water comes in from the top. As it goes down, the nitrate concentration will actually drop low. So if you look at the diagram on the right here, the line here, the blue, is dissolved oxygen. So you will, the dissolved oxygen, as the water flows down, will get lower. And then the black line is for nitrate. So as it uses up the oxygen, the nitrate starts to get depleted, and nitrate comes to zero. And then after nitrate, you see the perchlorate comes down. So if you need nitrate and perchlorate treatment, you need to first remove all the nitrate before you get to the perchlorate. So that's the takeaway for that. So this is the project for City of Delano. This is the state-funded, the Department of Water Resources-funded project, and also there's funding from the State Board as well. It's a fixed bed process. They have one well 35. It's a 570 gallons per minute well. It's only treating 200 gallons per minute of the well to break down the nitrate to a low level, and then they blend it with 370 gallons of bypass. It's a full-scale demonstration facility, and it's about to start up now. So if interested, I really invite you guys to go for a field visit, if possible, to this facility, because this is the new technology that's at the state funded. So we'll keep you posted once it's up and running, and if there's a tour available, you guys are more than welcome to go visit. So this is the full scale, what the plant looks like. It's pretty huge, probably size of a basketball court. It has the blue tank there, there are two of them. One of them is the biological process tank. So the water goes from top to the bottom, it breaks down the nitrate. And then they have a second filter that looks substantially the same for removing all the biomass. And then so it's very similar. Here's just some more pictures of all the chemical additions, the different chemicals they need, and also just a row of chemical pumps. All these are the different chemicals that they need put in to make sure the process works properly. This is the biocatalyst I mentioned about. This is the project in Sunny Slope, water company. This is in LA area near Pasadena. This is a vendor funded project. So this is the one that they have the pre-populated bacteria inside the little beads, and so they're going to go forward with a demonstration project to demonstrate it works. Two more technologies. One is what we call a continuous stir tank reactor. All it means is that you have water recirculated. Think of your washer tub, the old school ones, and they have little crouton sized foam recirculating it to be the substrate for the bacteria to attach and grow. So that's CSTR. And then the last one is the membrane biofoam. This is the one that the water actually flows as a spiral from the inside as a roll of membrane. So the water goes up tangentially, and then you use the membrane fiber to bring the electron donor, in this case, hydrogen gas. So treatment performance requirement, I think that's the key. For biological, just like for ion exchange, we need consistently low nitrate and nitrite MCL. The excess biomass is removed so that you don't cause a problem in the distribution system. The water needs to be low turbidity so you can disinfect it effectively. We require continuous disinfection so you don't want live bacteria going in the system. The treated water must be re-aerated to provide dissolved oxygen, because for this process to work, if you depleted all the oxygen, you need to bring back the oxygen. You need to comply with all other drinking water standards, namely disinfection byproducts, and taste and odor, because that's the part that if you can go into sulfate reduction, you can have a problem. And since you have put in all these acids, you may need to do corrosion control as well. So it depends on the blending ratio. That's something the water system needs to look into. So to ensure the system's overall reliability, there needs to be online instruments that are used to monitor chemical feeds and all the different different parameters. So it's an automated, very complex system. So flow is one step up from ion exchange. So for that reason, due to the complexity, we consider it a T3 facility, or treatment level 3 facility. The big concern for this, or something to consider, there's just a general lack of water system operators, designers, and even regulators that's familiar with this family of technology. It's so new to us. There's long-term treatment reliability is not known. There are many groundwater systems have only one source and no storage tank. So essentially, asking the system to run 100% on spec all the time, which is a very tall order. Intermittent operation could be a problem, especially if you're in a hot sun, that the temperature when you're sitting there, during the day, the temperature can go really high. Will it harm or will it kill some of the bacteriological activity when you start using water again? And so we have three projects that I mentioned, one at Delano, and then one in West Valley Water District in San Bernardino, and also Sunny Slope. They all have backup supplies, and they will, based on their study and how they work, all of them have demonstration, multi-year demonstration, we'll see how well they work, and then go from there. So our perspective is biological treatment is an emerging group of technology in drinking water applications, and we just need more experience before we will try using it in smaller water systems. So our general philosophy has always been allow the live system that have multiple sources to be the trailblazers, work out the designs, and then we'll see how we can adapt it and adopt it for small water systems. So the Delano project, just to talk a little bit of numbers, it's like as I mentioned, it's 570 gallons per minute total flow, 200 gallons per minute for the facility. The construction cost alone is $2.6 million. The overall project is $5 million. So their projected cost for the treated water is about $180 to $220 per acre foot for the treated water before blending, around $80 to $100 acre foot after it's blended to 80% of the drinking water standard. So the total project cost is $5+ billion. The plus part is $5 million is what's maxed out at the Department of Water Resources, plus the State Board has provided funding for some of the pilot work that we need to see where the intermittent work, intermittent operation will provide sustained performance. So here's a summary table for the current technology. So overall, we have six companies that have biological process that we have reviewed and we consider traditionally accepted. So what they have done is they've shown us that they understand their process, they're able to control their process, so now they're finding a large full-scale water system to pilot and see how it works. So the three projects that are live that I put in red, so that's the West Valley one for perchlorate, the Delano for nitrate, and Sunny Slope also for nitrate. So last treatment options to talk about. This is more UCLA's technology and also for point of use device for reverse osmosis. So point of use, actually, I'm not for, since I don't have it, but I'll cover, for UCLA, their process is a full-scale reverse osmosis treatment. So we have been working with Madeline and Europe co-ed from a division since the beginning of the project. We've been working with them at the headquarters level. So I work with them a lot on it. So I believe their target is similar to all the other treatment. If they treat a portion of the water, they blend it back together to 80%. Otherwise, the reverse osmosis water could be very soft and it can cause problems with corrosion. So we're working with them. We provide the technical assistance to them and then coordinate along with John and Angela in kind of like visiting a lot of sites, both in the Central Valley and here. And it's great to hear that the project is moving forward in your region. So reverse osmosis is kind of like one of the big things that we see is based on point of use treatment devices are likely the best option for nitrate and other contaminants for private homes and very small water system. And the reason I say that is it's kind of like these are well pre-built, pre-engineered systems. There are certification available, they're certified home treatment devices. The key difference is the adequate feed pressure is critical. For them to work well, because most people's home only have 20 and 30 PSI, it may not be efficient enough to reduce nitrate to below drinking water standards. So if we're dealing with nitrate that's over twice the MCL, they have units with a booster pump that can enhance the feed water to the membrane to make sure that it is able to treat the water that's below the standard. So just want to make sure that doesn't get lost. Prop maintenance is very critical. It's not something that we can just drop off at people's home and say, like, your problem is solved. It needs routine maintenance. One of the key things is there needs to be battery replacement on these units as well to give you kind of like a warning, hey, it's time to change your filter. And then also, just the routine change of the components are critical. Like, they have pre-filters that's clogged up. If it's clogged up, you won't have enough feed pressure for it to work properly. So the TDS, so to make sure the membrane is working, we use total dissolved solids or electroconductivity. So they can have a baseline to see how well the membrane is working and then go from there. And then the key thing is annual laboratory testing will be important for them to make sure the system is still working as designed. So the arrow-based POU, the one big issue is concerns for the regional board in particular is the discharge consideration. We feel from the Division of Drinking Water is a very useful option for very small public water systems, for the ones that below public water systems, as interim solutions to provide safer drinking water for a variety of contaminants. Consolidation as a long-term solution is always our concept. If people are willing to connect and they're near a water system, they should consolidate. The ROPOUs are likely the only affordable solutions for private homes and non-public water systems, because it is just very difficult for them to drill an own new well or something for themselves. And for ion exchange, it's just too complex for them, or they'll be operating very inefficiently. So we really need consistency on acceptance of use by the local regional boards so that we can communicate effectively with the county as they go out and work with these homeowners. Like, these are assured solutions that you can use, and we can go from there. So the one thinking point is like, a lot of times they said, well, you have nitrate, you have a concentrated residual, and you put it into the septic, is it a problem? But my suggestion, if you take a step back and look at the entire home as a water system, you have a clean water stream and a concentrate that goes back into the same septic. So it's really, in essence, no difference than what before. Maybe a little bit that you drank and you walk away with it, but as a whole picture, the nitrate increase will be very, very tiny, and it's really not a technical concern. So here's the summary table that you have for you. So the technologies that I've covered today provide a handy comparison. So for biological process, we have three in progress. For ion exchange, we have multiple systems around the state that's using it, but they have the benefit of a brine line. As in Southern California, they move the brine to the ocean for disposal. And then for our point of use, we have a lot, endless number of people have it at home for that is not for drinking water compliance purposes, but as interim and small water system solutions, we have quite a few going on right now. I think I've covered the majority of this already, and I didn't want to take up more of the time. And I think I just want to open up for questions.
Thank you for your presentation. I will start on my right. Ms. Cervantes, any question? Mayor Delgado? Dr. Hunter?
Yes, I'll try to be brief. Thank you very much for your presentation. You asked a lot of questions for me about the diversity of methods. So it helps to see it all over time, because typically we get, you know, with one project, we'll see what happened and so forth. So that very helpful for clarity. Some really straightforward questions. Can you tell me what is 80% of 10 milligrams per liter? What does that look like? Is it 20 milligrams?
It's eight.
So the target is actually, that's where I get confused.
Right.
If the standard is 10 milligrams per liter and above that, then it's out of compliance.
Right.
But we're asking, we're saying these systems should reach at least 8% of the standard. So that's, what is that, a safe factor there of an additional 20% where the system might fluctuate?
And part of it's because different analytical technology, the online analyzers uses a UV method. It's not a federal approved method for nitrate, but it tracks it really well. Mm-hmm. So and then we use, for compliance, they use laboratory samples. So it's part of that fudge factor,
okay.
The 2 milligrams, it's for analytical differences. and for response time. So as they see that the system, like we would expect them to set a target at 8, and then have the first alarm at 9, and then 9.5 is the second alarm, 9 and 8, it's like I'm shutting down. So it's just kind of, it allowed people room to work with and to respond to a treatment problem.
Well, that makes sense and makes me feel a lot happier.
We don't want people to work at the lodge. We need always leave a bucket.
Right. Let's see. The other thing that you mentioned when you were, towards the end of your presentation, you mentioned UCLA and the methodology going in there. But the system you described was an under sink system in house.
Right.
And my understanding is that
UCLA is not like that.
UCLA,
the UCL project involves a centralized treatment system that they put in adjacent to the well. So they're going to be treating the water using high efficiency RO so that they have very low nitrate stream, and they're going to blend it back to probably 80% of drinking water standard, and then allow that water to go into the system. In working with Dr. Yoram, they were looking at, it's just kind of like future projects. It's just kind of like, when we treat the water, you have a lot of the water goes to outside use, a lot of water is inside use, perhaps building a second distribution system to have just indoor water. So those are all the down the line things.
Yeah.
I think right now it's just proving by installing 3 systems that's remotely operated, just to keep it simple.
Yeah.
And the remote control concept's working well and the systems are robust. Then we take it on to the next step on perhaps some of the distribution system. And I forgot to introduce, this is Kurt Souza. He is the acting grad chief for the Southern California Division of Drinking Water. So
yeah, I'm hanging out with him today, answering his phone, as you can see. But one other thing that Yoram's thing will look at is the ability to operate remotely with less cost of operations on site. Is these things, what he showed you, biological treatment and ion exchange, tremendous amount of operator experience and time is needed to run those. RO, you know, goes under your sink, you can leave it there for a couple years. And we want to see if those systems can run for a long period of time without an operator checking them constantly. And that could be a large benefit to small communities. We just don't know if it's possible to do.
Right, yeah. So I think there are going to be a number of dimensions in this pilot that will help inform and refine. And as you said, we don't know yet exactly what the challenges will look like in specific, you know, combining correlation with how the system functions in the remote aspect of it. There's a lot that we're going to learn. But one thing that interested me, and this may not be true, where you're treating at the wellhead for high nitrate concentrations, so way above, you know, 10 times the MCO. So in those cases, I think that's where this pilot system is going, in places that are really high above the standard. You mentioned that there is a possibility, or the concept that you have high nitrate levels, you have other contaminants possible, and then when you treat, you have those things that are moving through the system in addition to the brine that's removed. And you get, so you have a clean water stream, and then you have the residual stream that has whatever contaminants. And then if it's discharged to a septic, you said, well, there's not much of a problem there because that water was already going into the septic. So we're not really looking at an increased rate. Is that the same thing? Would that be the same concept for the UCLA project? Because I know the discharge is still being questioned.
And I think that's the part that you guys are the experts. We look at the drinking water treatment. We know if we just do a mass balance, it shouldn't be worse off, but you'd be expanding to the entire neighborhood. But if you're looking at all of the, if maybe a graphic community of 25 there on septic, and if you look at that as your area, then it kind of balances out. So it's just kind of like, I think we need to look at it at a different scale. How do we clean up water regionally? But
I'm asking you, you know, from your perspective, because we are, I think, as a team of the staff and working with UCLA, I think that's one of the big issues that they need to look at every possible way that we can at least explore what the permit So like in what conditions will constrain what that, how effective the sewage system actually is in practice.
I think for the reverse osmosis system, both from point of view, this could be a good kind of like big quick triage system interim while we figure out how to deal with like perhaps additional treatment of the brine, how to remove the contaminants before it's discharged. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like maybe perhaps we can be broken into two problems, like how do we quickly clean up the drinking water problem, and then how do we have a timeline to improve the discharge.
Right, that's a really good point. Thank you for helping me with that. Then the last thing I wanted to touch on, I had a chance to talk with some of the division of drinking water folks that are now, you know, joining our process in different ways and recently on the tour. And there was discussion of what the human impacts of high levels of nitrate are. And the answer that, or at least the ideas that were expressed were, as you said, were primarily concerned with impacts to pregnant women and impacts to infants. But we also heard from San Gerardo, where there is a long history of other kinds of problems. So physically, adults are impacted in ways that are visible. So they express rashes, severe rashes that are really quite beyond uncomfortable. They're painful. They experience hair loss. And I was told by one of the persons I was speaking to that there really isn't any other impact to adults. We're not concerned about elderly people who may be ill or with long-term diseases. We're not concerned that high levels of nitrate are going to affect these people. And I didn't have a response. I had never heard anybody say that before. So do you have any thoughts on that?
So, from the MCL, which is 10, to about 2 times the MCL, there really statistically isn't effects for healthy adults. Once you get twice the MCL, that's where there's not as much data and where people become much more concerned. So I'm not sure what San Gerardo's numbers were, but I recall they were extremely high. So other things happen as it gets higher. But the answer you received was probably, you know, a normal nitrate, you know, exceeds that we have are in the, you know, between 10 and 15, you know, maybe getting to 20. Once you get to 20, we become extremely concerned.
Well, okay, that helps me a lot, because the conversation actually was about, pardon me, the fact that, again, this is thinking more broadly, how we work as institutions and agencies serving community needs. Community health clinics typically are not informed on what is the profile for long-term exposure to high levels of nitrate in their drinking water. And as you know, when cooking with it, it concentrates. So now, if they've got a really high level and they're cooking with it, now they, you know, on a daily basis, they're cooking in it. So we don't even know what the, you know, cumulative levels might be. So my interest is in seeing how we can extend the education and outreach to these community health clinics. And I have personally spoken with many of these individuals and said, do the nurses, do the doctors have any kind of profile that they're looking for in these locations, disadvantaged communities, rural area communities, small systems, less than 5, where there is no testing? Are there profiles for what nitrate impacts might look like in normally healthy adults, but now unhealthy adults? And the answer is we never thought about it. I've heard that more than once, and I know it's anecdotal, but I'm simply saying here's another piece of the pie where perhaps working with public health, which you all have good relationship with the public health side, that we can start to think about how do we gather just kind of a primer on what does it look like. And if there is no data, which I'm thinking if we look more broadly, there is literature on what's going on at that level of long-term consumption. So that would be my suggestion, and I'm hoping that in some fashion in the work we're doing, we can bring that part of the discussion into, you know, into the light of these other solutions we're looking for. So there's information going out about what the concerns might be on health impacts.
Right, and it's even for the challenge with a really high nitrate concentration treatment effectiveness. It's kept, we actually worked with Community Water Center on the RO system to actually help articulate the problem with the certifiers for these devices. And they just kind of like, they seem really stumped as well. It's like, are you sure those are the right numbers? It's just kind of like, that's actually when they said, okay, they did studies and say, oh, we can be sure these systems will work well if you just put in the booster pump. So they actually challenge tested it. They said, like, if you just run it on normal, it doesn't do anything, shave it down a little bit. It goes from, well, it's from 50 down to 40, right? Not good enough. But if you, that's a concern. So they actually kind of like to try to develop this literature, but at least the best thing they've done is to give us a technical background from their side. It's like, get the booster pump system. So I learned from them. So that's great. And I think as we move down the path of all these state smalls and systems that we don't regulate, I think we will be seeing different levels that we don't expect. Because for community water system wells, they have minimum construction requirements that generally deeper, have a good sanitary seal. So the levels we see generally is just over the MCL. And then I think the highest one when I was working in the field, maybe it's up to using current standards, maybe like 14, it would be as high. But they have multiple wells they blend together so that they can continue to use that source.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Young?
Thank you. Thank you for a very informative presentation. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
If you'd help for us, you said short period of time for consumption of water that has elevated levels of nitrate is problematic. What is the short period of time?
It's so hard to define. That's why we said it's at all times that's being served.
I actually think children under 6 months can be affected within like 3 days.
But is that continually drinking water for 3 days?
Yeah.
So drinking a glass of water isn't going to hurt anybody. But a 3 day period.
It's like 2 or 3 days of continuous use. A baby can, you know, how many people actually give water to a baby? It would have to be mixed in a formula, right? that could start to affect them. And there is another consideration. Other countries have higher nitrate limits than we do. So 10 is a fairly conservative number. So I'm not sure if 11 would affect you in a short period of time, but if you have enough nitrates to affect you, it will affect you in a few days.
And these other countries?
Israel has 15. We used to have 90 until like the 50s. I'm sorry, it would be 20. Sorry, twice.
But over 20 is really problematic.
Yes, we consider 20, two times the MCL and the acute standard is extremely.
Yes. Do the rest of the developed countries of the world agree with that? Okay, I'm just curious. I have a reverse osmosis system in my kitchen in a white plastic box. It did a great job. Was it not also reducing nitrate?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it was.
So that's the interesting part that you brought. On those units, they certify them for different contaminants. So usually for nitrate, they certify the most expensive one for nitrate. But the ones probably at lower cost that doesn't say nitrate reduction, it will take out some of the nitrate as well.
Just depending on the pressure that you have at your house, it's habit reduction. It will take out some, but not a lot. The higher the pressure, the more the reduction.
It's like the higher cost one, they may use a better quality membrane that is tighter, so they will hold back the nitrate better. So your treated water nitrate concentration is lower. Why don't you use the ones? So it really, when you look at the box, it will tell you what are the contaminants this unit is designed to remove. It will list all the different contaminants. And if you are having a problem with nitrate, absence of actually going through a study, you need to buy the box that says it's certified for nitrate reduction. And even with that, you need to look at it. It says, okay, this unit has been tested to 30 psi heat pressure. So you need to make sure your water coming into your house at the kitchen tap is at 30 psi. If it's too low, it's not going to work well. If it's higher, it's fine. So, but the minimum feed pressure has to be 30. And since we're talking about it, if you ever go on vacation, when you come home, make sure you flush out the unit so that it's making fresh water, because the way reverse osmosis work is you have the solutes, what's dissolved in it moves through the membrane at a constant rate. So when you're on vacation, the dissolved contaminants keep on moving, but there's no clean water coming to dilute it out. So it's important when you go on vacation, when you come back, flush it out so it's fresh water.
I don't have it anymore because my wife we were removing good minerals from the water.
You remember about that, that's true.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just want to thank you for the presentation. My colleagues have answered really all my questions, but it was very thorough. I greatly appreciate it.
So, a couple of points, and one of them I think Mr. Young gave me a good lead for it is that the issue of nitrate is not a California-centric issue, it's a worldwide issue. Other countries have done a lot of work associated with nitrates, and European countries where they have long-standing relationships with Africa, for example, based on their history. You know, I have done a fair amount of collaborative work with UNICEF and other groups in helping them for safe drinking water. So that has included methodology of nitrate treatment, but also clinical aspects. In Europe, specifically, example of countries would be Holland, would be France, would be Germany and Belgium have legacy pesticide, legacy fertilizers issue to the point where in some regions, counties, for example, have to bring the water from another county because of the significant concentration. I always like to think, you know, from an engineering and scientific standpoint, that there are a lot of great minds outside of our state and outside of our country. So has there been any effort in looking at work done in other parts of the world and see where we can use best practices?
So the ion exchange company that I talked about is actually a British company.
Okay.
So, and then for the electrodialysis, which was an Israeli company. So we're definitely there tapping into us because of a nitrate report, I would say, from the UC Davis nitrate report, that they see that there's a concern that we're putting the spotlight on it. So, and then for the biological treatment process, it's based on what we're talking about. I think people are gaining interest on it. So there are a lot of people thinking of creative way. It's like combinations. Like, oh, we use reverse osmosis to treat the water, and then we use biological process to treat the brine, and then before it's discharged. So there's like combination. There are lots of people's brains clicking on this.
So that's encouraging. And in fact, I was going to bring up Israel because in various aspects of water, including irrigation technology, you know, they certainly have been a very progressive country. So then my last question is, when we had a meeting with UCLA, I'm going to say 4 months ago, that was up toward the end of last year, you know, I asked a question to one of the two scientists about capacitive ion technology, and I received a rather strong rebuttal about the technology, which I felt, well, we need to keep an open mind here. I think UCLA is very, very much engaged with their RO technology, but I think, you know, we need to have an open mind of what else is available. And I pointed out to the great work done by Sandia Lab. And Sandia Lab has a tremendous amount of, you know, research. And do you have maybe another input? The feedback I got is like, oh, this doesn't work, and I've read a couple of papers about it.
So I think we actually have a good process in the Division of Drinking Water. We have a technology, that conditional acceptance process, So me and Kurt are actually the co-chairs for the water treatment committee. So a lot of people call us up and work with us on these technology. So we have new technologies for hexavalent chromium, you name it. They will come to us with good data from laboratory scale. And bench scale, and we actually give them suggestions like this is how you need to demonstrate a pilot so that we can consider it for condition acceptance and you can move on to public water systems. I will tell them about the materials requirements, you need to meet all these certification standards so it doesn't leach chemicals into it, so it's doing more harm than good. So we shepherd them through it and we get calls from all over the place. So I'm ruined now. But I'm still really open-minded and I really help them just to disclosure. I am a Bruin, but I do go work with them and explain it. And I think for this ion exchange company, I worked with them 4 years ago on this sulfate return and really stepped them through it and reissued the conditional acceptance to them at the end of February. So it takes time for a lot of these technology and all of them for they're the one for using Hexchrome and an Israel company we've worked through them. I just received the final report yesterday. So we do get a lot of and I think a lot of times in working with academics, which I get they reach out to us as well. A lot of times it is the gap between what works well in the lab and what works in reality. So we work with a group at UC Berkeley that they have simple water for arsenic treatment that they have a concept. And then so that we explain to them, like, for here, we need water is flowing continuously. You cannot have someone have a batch mode of treatment. So I think we're building the bridges, and I intend to keep doing that.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have two speaker cards on this topic. I'll start with Mr. Adam, 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Wolf and fellow board members. I just had one question for the engineer as far as the delivery of the, especially the RO system water. He had mentioned that it's corrosive, and then on another level it was, you know, you have this, you know, you can have ion exchange that happens in the delivery system, which is, I think it was the problem in Flint. I'm not really exactly sure what everything would happen there, but when you have a treatment system like that, is that going to be something that's going to be where the qualities are going to be tested on the delivered waters as well in all these testing in these programs?
Yes, for reverse osmosis, I think that's the part that, for example, if you say your water is coming in at 12 milligrams per liter, okay, so it's like 20% over the standard, so perhaps you'd just be only treating 30 or 40% of the water coming in down to a very low level, 1 or 2. So when you mix the water two back together, it's around 8. So you don't lose all your minerals. Maybe it's just reduced level of minerals, and your natural will meet the drinking water standard. But we'll still confirm that it's not corrosive. There's like different indices that we go through to make sure that the water is not impacting the pipes and then develop something like flint, because they eliminate the corrosion control, and that was the problem.
Great, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schimmick?
Steve Schimmick, the Outrider from the Marine Coast Keeper. I'll end with my question for the engineers, but first of all, I want to start with the bigger picture, step back. Water does not start as groundwater. It starts, you know, up there in the sky and comes down and falls down, and it flows through a medium, right, the soil. And that's where it picks up the nitrates. And that's where your first line of defense is going to be source control, limiting the sources of that nitrogen in the very beginning. Then, because ideally, you don't want to get to treatment at all. That's the ideal. Then the second piece is that then the water may flow off that media as surface water. And that's where wetland treatment, in other words, preserving the existing wetlands that we have now, becomes really, really, really important. And in fact, as I understand it, one of the things that was concentrated at the joint meeting of all the water boards was a focus on wetlands. And so we need to preserve those wetlands. Then we could also use engineered wetlands. And this might also be of particular importance in the lower Salinas. My organization actually paid for 2 sets of engineers to work together and come up with an engineered wetland proposal for the lower Salinas Valley. And one of the things that they did was that they looked at efficacy of engineered wetlands. And they actually found that the engineered wetland on Nolera Road was an order of magnitude more effective at removing nitrogen than any other wetland treatment reported in the literature from around the world. So whether it is the microbes that we have in it or the particular chemistry of the water, who knows? But from the black box in to black box out of the engineered wetland, our wetland in the Lower Salinas was incredibly effective. So I just wanted to step back and talk about the things that you need to do because we never want to get to that. And in a second, my question for the engineers is, it's also my understanding that high nitrates, at least and this is my belief, but I'm not sure, so I'm looking for confirmation. I also understand that there's increased cancer risk from high levels of nitrates for certain cancers. And I know that that's not an engineering question, but we, you know.
In the things that we have in our regulations, they don't mention that. But I've heard that too, and I know there's some additional research on how high the nitrate needs to be to increase the risk of cancer. And I know the EPA and others are looking at it, but there's not enough information at this time to answer you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that's good. I actually think that it's included in the EPA fact sheet on nitrates that they're. But I don't know if they use a qualifier or not, but they mentioned something like that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Schimmick. And, you know, in your comment about wetland, you are correct that it has been, and it is a focus. And there have been some projects performed with filter strips and having certain choices of grasses to actually trap, you know, some of the nitrates. So thank you for your comment. Any other input from staff on this topic? Okay, so then we will close this item 21. And it is 12:30, and we will enter into a closed session for 1 hour. And we will reconvene at 1:30. Would you like to add a comment?
I'd just like to announce that during closed session, we'll be discussing personnel.
Thank you very much.